This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. As dollar stores pop up all over rural communities in Illinois, how does that impact the rest of the economy?
It has been a zero-sum game where the Dollar General gain is the local grocery store's loss.
WGLT's Eric Stock talks to Chris Merritt of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs about the rise of discount stores and the fall of everything else. Plus, Mike and Murph with a new episode of WGLT's Grow. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. When the economy suffers, as it has in many rural central Illinois communities, shoppers tend to become bargain hunters, looking for the best deals to help stretch their ever-thinning dollar. That has helped expand the market for discount stores. As WGLT's Eric Stock reports, those stores are helping to fulfill a need, but economists wonder if those everything-is-a-dollar stores are only making matters worse.
Julie Cady of Broadwell loves shopping at the Dollar Tree store in neighboring Lincoln. She commutes there daily for her work in home daycare and at the local Cracker Barrel. In fact, she shops there
a lot, and my mom daily. My mom, it's her favorite place in the world is the Dollar Tree.
Why is that?
Well, because everything's a dollar.
That's a sentiment more than a few people in Lincoln share. It's a community that's been hit hard by job losses in recent months. The Dollar Tree that Katie pulled into is directly across the street from a recently shuttered Kroger store. That leaves three grocery stores in the town of about 14,000 residents, Walmart, Aldi, and IGA. Not exactly an abundance of shopping options for fresh food.
Walmart is so big, and they're always out of everything. And the other grocery store, IGA, is home-owned, or locally owned, and it's so expensive. So, like, elderly people especially, Walmart is so big. They loved to go into Kroger's and can get stuff so much easier. And so I think it's very, very, very missed.
Rebecca Curry was born and raised in Lincoln. She brought her two teenage sons to the Dollar Tree to pick up supplies to plant flowers that she got free from a local church. She shops at the Dollar Tree several times a week.
The economy is hard right now. It's really bad. Jobs are short. People are trying to save money.
Curry is unemployed and her husband works at Caterpillar in Peoria while her sons are detasseling corn at a local farm this summer. Her family, like many, are budget conscious.
Not everyone in town with our economy can afford to go to Walmart and spend $5 on ibuprofen when we can come here and get it for a dollar. I know the economy is pretty rough here.
Lincoln residents say it's a mystery why Kroger closed. Tracy Welch is mayor pro tem in Lincoln. He says Kroger pulled out because the cost of doing business at that location was too high. That's just one of several setbacks the Logan County seat has taken in the last few months. Glass and metal manufacturer Ardagh Group closed its Lincoln plant in April, eliminating 150 jobs. Prior to that, Alexander Lumber of Bloomington announced it was closing its Lincoln store. Welch says he's concerned about the spin-off effects of losing those big employers and how it impacts other businesses that rely on that customer base. And several restaurants have also shut their doors in Lincoln.
The economy in the state of Illinois and in the country is going through a bit of a cycle now, and we have to be conscious to support all of our businesses if we want those to stay there, because, as you know, when businesses close, people lose jobs, and when people lose jobs, they start to do things that we're talking about here and trying to find cheaper alternatives.
Lincoln is far from alone in experiencing the loss of manufacturing jobs that have hollowed out the economy. Chris Merritt has seen it before. He's director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. His office has studied the impact that dollar stores have on rural communities.
If you look at small towns that have, in fact, seen their grocery store, their family-owned grocery store, go out of business, as a result of a Dollar General coming in, then I think the argument would be that they're in fact making it worse.
Merritt says discount stores can effectively serve a low-income population. Sometimes with name brand items and longer hours, you might not find at your local grocer. What you rarely find is fresh food. Staffs tend to be smaller with minimal overhead. Merritt says in some respects, dollar stores took the Walmart model of supply chain management and low-cost delivery, using its wholesale purchasing power to sell its products for less than any competitor. Only the dollar stores took it a step further.
Now what Dollar Generals are doing is they are going into communities that Walmart would never have even considered. They are lower income. In an urban setting, they tend to be minority, lower income neighborhoods. In rural areas, again, they would be more lower income.
Merritt says while dollar stores are competing with Walmart from below, the retail giant has conceded some of that space, closing some lower performing stores so it can focus more on competing with home delivery retailers like Amazon. And while Walmart's meteoric rise often came at the expense of the mom and pop stores in rural America, Merritt says the dollar stores seem to be having much the same effect.
Store managers will say in their mind there's no doubt. So it's not a coincidence. It has been a zero-sum game where the Dollar General gain is the local grocery store's loss.
And dollar stores can have a big impact on smaller communities, but for urban communities like Bloomington Normal, they are ever present. The Twin Cities has 13 dollar stores and will soon add a 14th. That'll give the community as many dollar stores as McDonald's, Taco Bell's, and Burger King's combined. That 14th store is a Dollar General that's going up at the former Family Video in South Bloomington. It's less than a mile from another Dollar General, and it's in the same area the U.S. Department of Agriculture has specified as a food desert. Unlike Dollar Tree, Dollar General does sell some stuff for more than a dollar, but still generally cheaper than what you can buy anywhere else. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner says it's not an ideal use of retail space, but
we do have this thing called the free market, and people can locate and sell their property in most cases however they want, unless it happens to be inconsistent with zoning or there are some other regulations or restrictions on them.
The city has been working with a nonprofit group that wants to bring a grocery store to a West Bloomington neighborhood. Renner says Bloomington Normal is large enough to where another dollar store won't have much impact, but he'd like to see more economic diversity in those neighborhoods where access to fresh food is scarce.
We can certainly afford some Dollar Generals, but we also need to make sure that we leverage our full potential. And with all respect to Dollar General, lots of Dollar Generals are not reaching our full potential. I think there's some other businesses that we could mix in there that are more beneficial to the community, that will perhaps pay better.
Some dollar stores have started selling fresh food. Back in Lincoln, there's a Dollar General on the city's east side that sells refrigerated food, such as milk, lunch meats, and eggs, but no fresh fruits or vegetables. It's next to a mobile home park in a community that lacks quick access to a grocery store. Mary Hayes of Lincoln was shopping there. She's retired from a career in the medical field. She says for some in that lower-income neighborhood, that is their grocery store.
That is why this store expanded and added a grocery area. For those people that live here, they don't have to go all the way out to Walmart.
And those economic realities can raise health concerns. Food stamp recipients through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program can use their benefits at dollar stores, but young mothers who are in the WIC program cannot. WIC stands for Women, Infants, and Children. Its benefits are similar to SNAP, but can't be redeemed at dollar stores because of the lack of healthy food. Paige Mintz is a nutritionist with the McLean County WIC program. She says most food you get at the dollar store is bad for you, overly processed so it doesn't go bad. That means unhealthy levels of sodium in just about anything you buy.
The biggest thing with canned vegetables is the sodium content, so just teaching them how to use those canned things. So if they rinse them off in the sink before using them, that can be a great way to reduce that sodium.
Mary Colby runs the McLean County WIC program. She says it relies heavily on education to help families make healthy food choices, but she understands the lure of getting something to eat quick and cheap. She concedes some options are worse than others.
I can see how some people may run to the dollar stores or discount stores to purchase a few items. However, I do feel like that's more beneficial than running to a gas station and picking some things up there. So there can be some pros and cons.
Customers will ultimately decide the winners and losers in the retail and grocery marketplace by how they spend their dollars. Chris Merritt at the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs says it's better to spend your money local.
Whereas the profits from the local family-owned grocery store would have been reinvested locally or spent locally, the Dollar General profits, they will be, you know, repatriated back to headquarters in Tennessee and to shareholders.
Merritt says it's easy to take for granted what mom-and-pop stores do for a community that larger conglomerates can't. He says many don't realize what they've got till it's gone.
They see their local grocery store, it might be struggling, but they don't have enough incentive to spend a few more pennies at the local grocery store rather than Dollar General. They don't fully appreciate it. And then, of course, when the grocery store goes out of business, then they kind of go, oh, now I see what happened.
Dollar Tree has also moved to eliminate some of its national competition. Dollar Tree acquired Family Dollar in 2015. It closed close to 400 of those stores and are rebranding about 200 others as Dollar Trees. Four dollar stores open in the U.S. every day. I'm Eric Stock.
Dollar Tree and Dollar General declined WGLT's request for interviews. Dollar Tree issued a statement saying, quote, our stores provide an affordable and convenient shopping option for customers while creating jobs and investing in the communities we serve. Staying in the world of food in rural Illinois, Tim Shelley reports on how four central Illinois towns are fighting for fresh food as well as community survival.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture defines a food desert as a census tract with a lot of low-income people or low access to a grocery store. Rural areas more than 10 miles from a grocery store qualify as a food desert. The nonprofit organization Feeding America says 2.4 million rural households face hunger, and 75% of the counties with the highest areas of food insecurity are in rural areas. This includes central Illinois. Several rural towns have seen their only grocery stores disappear in recent years. Delavan Finer Foods burned down 5 years ago, leaving the Tazewell County community of 1,600 people without a grocery store. No one rebuilt it. In February of this year, Minunk's Grossenbach Grocery closed for good after years of struggling to stay open. Chris Merritt is the director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. He says many stores haven't been able to weather the hollowing out of rural America.
Grocery stores have always been a narrow profit margin industry to begin with, very competitive, and quite simply, there are grocery stores in small towns that have just gone out of business.
Dollar General stores and gas station convenience stores have filled the void in many small towns, leading to what one expert calls food swamps rather than food deserts. Sean Park is the program manager at the Institute for Rural Affairs Value-Added Sustainable Development Center. He says many Dollar General stores now sell frozen food, canned goods, and some dairy. He says in many cases, the chain's goods are just cheap enough to drive mom-and-pop grocers out.
What happens then is the community's left with nobody that sells fresh produce, fresh meat, those types of items.
This forces people to drive 15 to 20 miles to a larger city like Peoria to buy fresh food. Chris Merritt of the Institute for Rural Affairs suggests traveling for groceries is still often healthier for people than buying processed foods at dollar chain outlets. Sean Park says he's assisting in work that is underway to bring fresh food back to four local towns, Toulon, Delavan, Princeville, and Mount Pulaski. In Princeville, Mayor Jeff Troutman says the Village Foods grocery store closed about a year ago. Many residents of the Peoria County Village of 1,600 people work and shop in Peoria, about 20 miles to the southeast. Troutman says a recent survey started by a local school district to assess the village's food wants and needs garnered more than 400 responses. Princeville School District 326 Superintendent Shannon Dooling and Princeville State Bank are working with Sean Park and the Value-Added Sustainable Development Center to open a co-op grocery store run by the school district and assisted by students. Park says students in the high school's agricultural program could sell their food in a store, and students with special needs could work there. A meeting at the high school next month will explore the next steps. Meanwhile, Jim Nolan is working to open Ben & Julie's in a converted hardware building in Toulon within a few months. In addition to fresh food, Nolan says the store will have a deli, a cafe, and a delivery service for those with mobility challenges. He says in this age of convenience, it's not enough to just be a grocery store anymore, especially in a small town. You have to find a way to stand apart.
The need of the present is for a mix of activities, including a place to hang out, which many little towns don't have anymore, and also a place where you can drop in quickly and pick up high-quality items.
Western Illinois' Merritt agrees. He says a small town loses something more than just a source of food when a grocery store goes under. It's social center.
It can be a real gut punch, if you will, when a small town loses its grocery store, because it's more than simply a place to buy cereal.
But opening a grocery store in a small town requires more than offering a blend of food and other services. Sean Park, the value-added sustainable development center, says it ultimately requires finding someone to champion the cause and gain community buy-in. That's where Delavan is in the process currently. Tori Dahlhoff is the rural development coordinator for the Greater Peoria Economic Development Council. He says rural grocery stores succeed by embracing technology and innovation and with community support.
It's kind of a all-hands-on-deck approach that's needed, where it's community-supported, but it's also driven by technology and innovation to really come up with some different and new models that don't exist yet.
Dahlhoff's larger role at the EDC focuses on building the food supply chain in central Illinois to drive economic development from farms to the dinner table. The region already has farmers growing specialty crops, mills processing raw materials, and community grocery stores selling the final product. Dahlhoff says the challenge is making all those pieces work together in a coordinated way.
There are all these great little projects happening, but it's not happening at any real scale yet that could feed more people.
The U.S. EPA's Local Foods, Local Places program might help the region develop such a supply chain. Both Peoria and Mount Pulaski in Logan County are among 14 communities nationwide selected to participate in this year's program. Dahlhoff says he hopes having both an urban and a rural community in central Illinois involved in the program will help generate new solutions for food insecurity. Jim Nolan of Toulon says it's a matter of small communities and even mid-sized towns finding a niche to fit into in the 21st century as major cities attract more talent.
Well, I don't have a magic wand, and so I don't know the answer. But I do know the first step is to focus on what these cities and small towns can be.
Ultimately, the fate of grocery stores in rural America may be tied to the fate of small towns themselves. I'm Tim Shelley.
The Regional Fresh Food Council is set to release its new study on the food insecurity problem in the city of Peoria and how to tackle it soon. This is Sound Ideas.
The news you need when you want it. That's what you'll find at our website, WGLT.org. The latest local news stories, plus reports from Springfield, Washington, and around the world. You can also subscribe to our podcast and catch up on your favorite GLT features, from GLT's Grow to John Norton's music interviews and everything in between. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
The state's pension problems are well documented, but now Chicago's pension obligations are in the spotlight as new Mayor Lori Lightfoot asks Governor J.B. Pritzker for help with a $1 billion pension cliff. In this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderator Sean Crawford is joined by NPR Illinois State House editor Brian Mackey, Charlie Wheeler from the U of I Springfield, and reporter Hannah Mizell from the Daily Line. Mizell opens a conversation about where things stand with the Chicago state pension talks.
Well, the city of Chicago is facing probably a $1 billion, if not more, $1 billion budget shortfall. And, you know, the mayor's only been in office for 6 weeks, couldn't get much done in the way of Springfield help at the end of session because she had literally been in office for 10, 11 days by the time session adjourned. But, you know, so the mayor is looking at, she says she's looking at all options, but what had happened was she told Crane's Chicago Business that she wanted the state to take on some liability for pension payments. Pretty much immediately, the governor's office said, we don't think so. That is going to be pretty impossible. They met over the weekend on Saturday, didn't get much detail, but then on Monday, they you know, the governor said flat out, like, we can't do that. That would, taking on even more pension liability would basically tank our credit rating into junk status. And already we sit at just above junk status from two of the three major New York credit ratings agencies. And Fitch has us maybe two notches above, so still not much better. So, you know, that's going to kick off a new series, you know, of talks about pension consolidation, what to do about pensions, which I think is a welcome thing for a lot of Springfield observers who, you know, maybe they're happy about all the things that did get done this session, but still the grill in the room, the elephant in the room, excuse me for mixing metaphors, is the pension issue. You know, we've had lots of debates over whether to call it a crisis, whether, you know, the state can even do anything. Of course, we had that landmark Illinois Supreme Court ruling back in 2015 that invalidated the major pension overhaul that would have, you know, cut some benefits. So it's really an intractable problem. But, you know, now there is a pension task force that's going to give a report later this summer, I believe in August, about what can be done. But it's, I mean, options are limited.
And Brian, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, and just to build on what Hannah was saying, the intractable problem, you know, there's two ways to look at this. One is the headline number of, you know, $130 billion that Illinois owes for its pensions. I don't have off the top of my head the number for Chicago, however many billions that the pensions are underfunded in the city of Chicago. But that's sort of the long-term view. Is that a crisis? That was one of the arguments that a number of academics made earlier this year, is that that's not a crisis that we need to address now. That's something that years and years down the road, at some point, the Illinois pensions will presumably begin to have difficulty meeting their obligations and could, you know, enter some sort of downward spiral. The thing that people think of as a much bigger problem in the short term is this idea of crowding out, which is, increasingly, the state, if it follows the ramp put in place, the plan put in place in the 1990s to pay a little bit more into the pension system every year, that money is crowding out spending that could be done on things like education, higher education, secondary education, vocational education. So this idea of crowding out spending that could be done on other core priorities of government for pension payments that should have been made in the past. That is sort of the nearer term concern here. And that is something that, you know, it's a problem for the state, but it's, as Hannah said, it's a really big problem for a lot of municipalities in Illinois, which have been shorting pensions over the years and now don't really have the option to do that. The state is making them come up with the money. And so we've seen layoffs of firefighters and police officers in cities across Illinois. And tough decisions like that are going to continue to have to be made.
And Charlie, if I look at this and I'm a citizen of the state who doesn't follow state government, but somebody tells me, you know, well, we may have the state of Illinois take over more of these pension liabilities, I'd be thinking maybe that's not the best group of people to be in charge of these problems because they haven't dealt with it well over the many decades that that has led to the current situation. But these ideas have come up before in the state of Illinois. They haven't gone anywhere, though.
No, and part of it is, as Brian was saying, it's a question of crowding out. One of the reasons we're where we are is that over the years, the competition for dollars for things like education, human services, public safety, in a sense, crowded out what the state should have been putting in year after year to cover the cost of the benefits being earned by public workers in that particular year. And we haven't done that probably for 100 years or more. And so suddenly we're at a point where now we have to catch up on what we didn't do in the past. And in the past, legislators and governors, rather than put money away for 20, 30, 40 years in the future, they felt it more appropriate or more politically convenient to spend that money on services now and worry about the future later on, rather than, in a sense, be honest with taxpayers and say, look, we have to make some tough decisions, and it's better for us in the long run not to kick the can down the road and wind up paying humongous interest costs, but rather maybe either raise revenues to cover what we want to spend plus what we owe the pensions, or just cut back on what we want to spend so that we can responsibly fund the pensions over the years. And it happened at city levels too. Now, the pension problems we're talking about for municipalities basically are for police and firefighters. Interestingly enough, there's a fund that consolidates the pensions for everybody else, most everybody else who works for cities and counties. It's called the Municipal Retirement Fund. And because over the years, regularly, that fund has been sustained by the proper amount of contributions from all the member communities, it's pretty well funded. There's no emergency with the IMRF. It's in great shape. But it was because over the years, it's been properly funded year after year after year, whereas the police and fire have kind of gone by the wayside. And now, as Brian said, there's now a state law that says, municipality, you have to put in this amount of money. They have no choice about it. And that's where Chicago is. That's why Rahm Emanuel had to raise property taxes to make some of those payments. And I guess Mayor Lightfoot is facing the same dilemma.
Can I, and I would just like to draw a line from what Charlie was saying about years ago, these decisions to, I guess you could say, artificially keep taxes lower than what the state needed to be spending, both on current operations for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, and future pension payments. So people back then got a pretty good deal on taxes. Well, you draw that now to the future, and people who were getting a good deal on taxes back then are now often retired, collecting retirement income. And one of Mayor Lightfoot's proposals is to offset the cost if the state were to assume some of these pension burdens of municipalities, would be to start taxing retirement income. Now, Governor Pritzker campaigned against this idea, but there is a way to look at it. Okay, the people who are now collecting retirement income and not paying state taxes on that money, they are paying federal taxes, but not paying state taxes on those pensions, got a sweet deal decades ago, and now they're still getting a sweet deal in retirement. And as I've often pointed out on this program, that doesn't apply to old people who aren't fortunate enough to have been able to save for retirement. If you have to work until you're 80s, you know, the proverbial Walmart greeter, although Walmart is scaling back on those positions. But I had an aunt who was working in banquet facilities well into her 80s as a server. You know, this... those people are paying income tax on their income. So it is a potential source of revenue, but given the strength of AARP and the relatively high proportion at which people who are at retirement age tend to vote as compared to other demographics, politicians have been very reluctant to broach that subject.
Hannah, what about the idea of reamortizing the debt in the pension debt in the state of Illinois? That has come up before. I even think that was part of one of the groups that was working with the governor, you know, after his election, looked at that idea, and some people thought that had some merit as well.
Right. So, I mean, this idea of reamortizing what's called the 1994 pension ramp, which was implemented under former Governor Jim Edgar. So that gave us, what was it, 45 or 50 years to, I believe it was 50, to, you know, get to something like 90% funding of all of state pension funds. In his budget address, Governor Pritzker floated the idea of, you know, skipping out on $800 million, although some analysts said, you know, really it'd be close to $1 billion worth of pension payments this year, and then for the next 7 years, kind of smoothing out that curve. But the problem with that is that, you know, basically every dollar that you don't pay now, you're going to end up paying later, you know, probably with interest. So it'll save you in the short term, sure, you know, from crowding out those state services that also, you know, need money, and it's all competing dollars because it's all from the same general revenue fund. But, you know, you're going to end up paying later. And so that, I think, gives more. And also, he was roundly criticized in the press from, you know, all kinds of groups. Even Democrats were like, I don't know about this. But and so that's going to be a really, really difficult sell. And so after in April, we got this quote unquote April surprise of $1.5 billion unexpectedly into state coffers from, you know, income taxes. The governor canceled that and, you know, people breathed easy. And honestly, I think that was one of the, like, probably the linchpin of how everything worked out this session, because there wasn't that pressure, that monster kind of breathing down everyone's neck. But the governor still hasn't really said for sure whether he's let go of the idea of reamortization.
That's Daily Line reporter Hannah Mizell and the rest of the Illinois Politics Roundtable, including moderator Sean Crawford and panelists Brian Mackey and Charlie Wheeler. Coming up later in the show, Mike and Murph bring us another installment of WGLT's Grow. This is Sound Ideas.
Metta is the Sanskrit word for compassion, and on the album Metavolution, Rodrigo y Gabriela embrace their practice of meditation and healing. They also cover a legendary Pink Floyd song in its 19-minute glory. Rodrigo y Gabriela will talk about why they did it and perform on the next World Cafe.
It's World Cafe weeknights at 7 on Bloomington Normal's Public Media, WGLT.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. For decades, the number of men and women in Illinois prisons appeared destined for permanent growth. But several years ago, the population actually began getting smaller. Today, it's more than 20% below the high water mark. In this week's Illinois Issues In-Depth Report, IPR's Brian Mackey looks at what's beyond the trend.
A more direct way of saying behind the trend is who gets to take credit. We'll come back to this question in a couple minutes, but first, it's important to understand the context in which Illinois began locking up more and more of its citizens. The numbers began inching up in the 1970s. In the years that followed, Republican governors and Democratic legislators teamed up to lengthen prison sentences. The population doubled in the 80s and doubled again in the 90s. The number peaked on February 9, 2013, when 49,401 people were locked up. Projections had it going even higher, but that's not the way things worked out. The numbers began to drop, gradually at first, then more quickly, until late last year when the population dipped below 40,000 for the first time since the late 90s. The question is, why?
I think it's important to recognize that the idea that there's a single state policy that guides prison utilization isn't really accurate.
This is David Olson. He's a professor of criminology at Loyola University Chicago. Olson says there's no one policy because of how decentralized the criminal justice system is here. 800 police departments, 102 separately elected state's attorneys, hundreds of judges. So when the police chief in Dixon sets up a program where the drug addicts can turn themselves in for treatment instead of jail, that makes a little difference. For larger scale change, you have to go to the places that send the most people to prison, and that means Chicago and Cook County. Olson says the city has seen a huge drop in felony drug arrests over the last decade. In fact, a significant part of the statewide prison decline can be traced back to just three Chicago police districts.
And that's really been concentrated in specific neighborhoods. Just like the tripling and quadrupling of arrests in Chicago in the late 80s, tended to be concentrated in very specific neighborhoods.
Another significant drop is connected to retail theft. In 2016, nearly 1,000 people were in prison for the crime. By the end of last year, that number was cut in half. In between, Cook County got a new prosecutor.
The number one charge in 2016 that we were prosecuting was not guns, was not shootings. It was retail theft.
This is State's Attorney Kim Fox from an interview she gave last year with Chicago public radio station WBEZ. It's pretty easy for an Illinoisan to get retail theft up to a felony prosecution. All they have to do is steal more than $300 worth of stuff. That's a significantly lower threshold than a lot of states. Even though the law had not changed, Fox directed her lawyers to act as though it had.
From then on, retail theft would only be charged as a felony if more than $1,000 worth of stuff was stolen.
Some of the people that we were seeing repeatedly were not people in sophisticated retail theft rings. We saw people who were stealing because they were either homeless, had addiction issues, had mental health issues, poverty-related issues, and not threats.
This reminds me of something a criminal justice reformer once told me. He said, prison should be for the people you're afraid of, not the people you're mad at. Returning to Olson, the Loyola criminologist, that's the effect of what's happening. He says the population that remains in Illinois prisons consists of people convicted of more violent crimes. They're also older. Even so, the 20% drop in the prison population is remarkable, which brings us back to the question we started with. Who gets credit for the turnaround?
Everybody can have a little piece of the action.
Olson already talked about police and prosecutors. He says the legislature's contributed, and the Department of Corrections is trying to improve how it treats inmates, which leads to better outcomes. And then there's you.
The electorate now is more willing to allow for prison to not be the primary response behind crime. So everybody can take a little bit of credit, but if something goes bad, everybody will say it's not my fault.
Some things, it seems, never change. I'm Brian Mackey.
Now from prisons to gambling. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a bill at the end of June that allows for 6 new casinos in the state and legalizes sports betting. Rockford is the site of one such casino, and IPR's Chase Cavanaugh has more on how it'll contribute to local and state revenue.
A comprehensive gambling bill has been a repeated priority in the state legislature for several years. One of its biggest supporters has been Republican State Senator Dave Severson. He says a major concern is gambling dollars being lost to surrounding states.
Last year, a little over $1.5 billion left Illinois to go to the 5 surrounding states who have all built casinos on the borders.
Severson worked in tandem with Democratic Senator Steve Stollman, whose district comprises much of Rockford. One of Stottleman's priorities was funding a state capital plan, and some possible funding streams, like a tax on streaming videos, weren't well received by the public.
Eventually, most people came to realize that we could fund a majority of this capital plan through gaming expansion. And to me, that was the key to passing a larger package.
Stottleman says initial estimates on casino revenue would add at least $500 million for the capital fund. Severson adds that the capital plan sends the money to very specific sources.
That includes things for universities, K-12 school projects, state facilities, state parks. It's really dealing with deferred maintenance.
Municipalities like Rockford will also get a share of each casino's revenue, Stottleman explains.
70% for the city of Rockford, 20% for Winnebago County, and 5% for Loves Park and McChesney Park. So they'll divide up the amount that a local casino would bring.
Both senators say it's better for the revenue to remain in-state rather than go across the border. Severson is also concerned that cross-border casinos can open up more quickly because they aren't taxed as heavily as their Illinois counterparts. He uses the planned Ho-Chunk Casino in Beloit, Wisconsin, as an example.
Rockford would clearly be at a big disadvantage because the Indian Casino, by not paying taxes, makes a lot more money and can subsidize, you know, either their water park they're talking about or subsidize their hotels, or they can pay larger winnings.
Stottleman adds that the lost revenue isn't necessarily coming from the wallets of out-of-staters.
So we had Beloit to the north. You have Indiana casinos to the east. And I think any given day you look in the parking lots of those casinos in Indiana, again, all Illinois license plates.
Even with the state's legal blessing to expand casino gambling, the revenue estimates aren't perfect. Also, there are different tax regimes for different types of gambling. Stottleman says the video gaming machines commonly found in bars and restaurants are taxed at a flat rate of 30%. This doesn't apply to casinos.
But there's a progressive element to it. So the more revenue brings in, it's taxed at a higher rate.
Furthermore, the introduction of sports gambling brings in questions of what tax rate is ideal. Casinos are also devising different ways they can provide sports betting in a legal setting, while still appealing to the convenience of certain ways it's done, such as with mobile apps. Governor J.B. Pritzker says regardless of method, there's money to be made.
The ongoing revenue, not insubstantial, from tax revenue from sports betting, as it ramps up, is, I believe, between $20 and $40 million a year. Not a small amount of money, but relative to some of the other things, maybe smaller.
Finally, a portion of the tax revenue from Illinois casinos goes toward treatment for gambling addiction. Stottleman says that amount will be significantly higher than in the past.
The state will provide $6.8 million in treatment and services and therapy for gamblers who do have addictions. That's a 750% increase over what's currently provided. I think the current amount is $800,000.
At this point, Rockford kicked off an application process for parties interested in building and running the new casino. The city can send multiple applications to the Illinois Gaming Board for approval, but only one party will ultimately receive a state license. Once the Gaming Board makes its decision, the casino will set up a temporary site while their main building is under construction. Senator Severson hopes that can be done by the end of the year. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
You can find more news from around Illinois on our website. Just go to WGLT.org and find State News on the drop-down menu. This is Sound Ideas. The Fell Arboretum at Illinois State University's, it's a most visible gardening asset we have. But there are others, and combined, they could lead to a new botanical garden designation. ISU's Patrick Murphy explains to WGLT's Mike McCurdy during this episode of our gardening podcast, Grow.
Not an episode of Grow goes by that I don't mention that Patrick Murphy is the curator of the Fell Arboretum, but that's just one of the garden assets at Illinois State University. And here to talk about all of it is Murph, who is also with ISU's School of Biological Science. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow. Murph, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a plan to combine some of the various gardening assets, as we've put it, under one umbrella. But first, let's talk about the arboretum first, the Fell Arboretum. Where is it? How many trees? Is there a map? Give us a rundown.
Okay, the Fell Arboretum is right here at Illinois State University. And like all arboretums, it's a outdoor collection of trees and woody plants. Here at ISU's Fell Arboretum, we're talking 512 acres of continuous attached real estate that belongs to the university, where you will find somewhere around 2,570 trees.
Wow.
That's how many we had on Arbor Day of April 26th of this year. And recently, with the release of that map and the tree list that accompanies it, we have the very first full counting of the arboretum in documentation form and a shareable format since it was founded in 1996.
So how many unique species out of that 2,000-plus trees?
It's a little under 300 right now, so it's 287. And the funny thing is, you know, on Arbor Day, ISU planted a total of 5 trees that I'm aware of, and that could potentially have increased the number. But we're right around 287 distinct different trees and woody plants.
And the most unique tree in the Fell Arboretum?
Well, that's subjective, but we have a really impressive filbert on the West Campus walkway.
And does that produce the filbert nuts?
It can.
Okay.
It can. We have a beautiful American beech that's on the south end of campus near the Center for Visual Arts. And in the quad area, which is kind of the diversity hotspot for all the trees, we have a number of unusual oaks. We have some black gum hybrids. And we have some tried and true plants that have kind of outlived their normal life expectancy. In particular, there's one huge Austrian pine on the quad that's remarkably lived as long as it has.
What are the other gardening attractions at Illinois State University?
Illinois State University has just under a half dozen different assets. Next to the Fell Arboretum, my favorite would be the ISU Horticulture Center. It's an unattached public garden area that has parking and a place to wash your hands and get a drink of water.
And Constitution Trail access.
And the Constitution Trail locally can get you there as well. That is something that is put together for us through the Department of for the good folks in horticulture. And then from the Department of Biology, along with the Fell Arboretum, we have the Vasey Herbarium. And we also have the Felmy Collection Greenhouse. Those are both located in the Felmy Science Hall on campus.
When you look at all of these assets as a whole, what can an organization like Illinois State University do with them?
Talk about establishing a botanic garden with the distinction means that the gardening assets are kind of coalesced under one umbrella for the sake not only of education, but for community involvement and the sharing of other seeds and products that come from the arboretum.
Sharing with the public?
Potentially with the public and with other gardens a lot of times. And along with that, ISU is one of fewer and fewer schools that offer the courses of study in horticulture, landscape design, and landscape maintenance. So for us to have that feature and still teaching that shrinking curriculum, if you will, that would be a great asset. Southern Illinois University is the other school in Illinois that offers these programs.
Does botanic garden designation benefit the Fell Arboretum in any way?
Well, it's bound to. It may be indirectly, but for the Fell Arboretum, this initiative is a very good thing, particularly when it comes to strategic planning requirements that are part of becoming a public garden. That's true for the Arboretum itself, but the strategic planning stuff is true for the bigger botanic garden. And the strategic planning amounts to collaboration with educators here at ISU, staff, I'm a staff member, local experts, and even the university's architects, the folks that work in grounds. This should be a collaborative effort to help come up with some cutting-edge landscape features that would be additional assets and treasures to the botanic garden.
Tell me about the Vasey Herbarium. What is that?
An herbarium is a place where you would have a collection of plant tissues, small cross sections from woody stems. The Vasey Herbarium has been managed for years by Dr. Joe Armstrong, an emeritus botanist from the ISU's Department of Biology. There are samples in that collection that are no longer available. There are samples in that collection of very rare prairie plants that have only surfaced here and there since their decline, if you will. So it's kind of like a library. It's indoors. If you wanted to see that here at the university, you got to get in touch with somebody to go in, because it's kept behind lock and key, as it should be, because these are sensitive botanical samples.
Tell me what's going on at Ewing Manor.
Ewing Manor is the home for the Buck family at one time. That's a historic family here in the Midwest. And the fortune was made from selling concrete fence posts. And the home was made out of that same aggregate. I always thought that was interesting because the house smells like concrete when you go into it. But the grounds are beautiful. Grounds are maintained by ISU grounds workers and a ISU gardener. And it's also the home for the ISU Shakespeare Festival. But the grounds have a lot of wonderful pocket gardens and large display gardens, and it even has an authentic Japanese garden.
And you can access that via Ewing Park as well.
I think you could.
Yeah, I think you can come in the back way that
That's
way.
Right.
Yeah. Is there an accreditation process for becoming a botanic garden? Who designates? What's the process like?
There is an accreditation for all public gardens, so similar to the Arboretum. The minimum requirement typically starts off with a map and a full listing of all the plants that are in it. And then from there, you have other requirements about the strategic planning is the biggest one. What are you doing to realize the best outcomes? What are you doing to avoid known unfavorable outcomes? What's the level of collaboration? Is it perceived collaboration, or is it real collaboration?
You said there was a new map of the Fell Arboretum. Where is that available?
If you go to the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences, you can see the map. It's right on the front page there. Similarly, within the ISU Biological Sciences webpage, you can find the Fell Arboretum webpage, and you can see the map and the list there as well.
And will there be some hard copies available in the community at some point?
There could be in the future, but the map is very large because it covers a 512-acre area. And producing the maps to sell or share to the public is a substantial cost, but it's not without possibility.
This botanic garden designation, could that turn ISU into sort of a tourist destination for people who want to come and look at some of these assets?
I don't see how it would turn out any other way. Of course, it's going to be people that perhaps went to ISU, but I think about people that visit public gardens, like yourself and myself. You go all over to visit them. You make it a day's worth of activities. The way things are situated here at Illinois State with our botanic gardens and our relationship with Bloomington Normal, there's be plenty of places to stay, plenty of places to get something great to eat, plenty of places to have fun when it's dark, because you can't enjoy the botanic gardens in the dark. And ISU is ready to roll out the red carpet for anybody that wants to come and visit any of the garden assets here.
If you have any questions about the Fell Arboretum or Botanical Gardens or about anything in your garden or landscape, send them our way and we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org/grow.
You can hear Grow weekly on WGLT's Sound Ideas. You can find the podcast right now at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas, interviews, and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Tim Shelley, Mike McCurdy, and our friends at IPR. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page, where WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.